glory of the one and only, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning him. He cries out, saying, "This is he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me has surpassed me, because he was before me.' From the fullness of his grace, we have all received one blessing after another. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, has made him known."
Brilliant, Dio. Thank you very much. You might want to keep those verses in front of you. We're not allowed to give you Bibles. We'd normally have them in the pews, wouldn't we? But that's why it's written on the service sheet as well, so you can follow along if you would like to. I want to tell you about a man named St. Nicholas. He lived 1,700 years ago. The picture on the left is probably what he actually looked like. The picture on the right is what he looks like in our minds today. It's from Arthur Christmas, if anyone doesn't recognise the movie. He is most famous, isn't he, St. Nicholas, for giving gifts to the poor. But in the 4th century, he was the bishop of a place called Myra, which, if you've never heard of it, is, of course, in Turkey. Anyway, he was also a man who agreed with what John wrote at the beginning of his gospel that we've been looking at these past few Sundays, that Jesus, the Christ, was with God and was God. Now, we know that St. Nicholas here agreed with that because in the year AD 325, St. Nicholas, along with 300 other church leaders, he was summoned to have an important discussion in a place called Nicaea. Because there was another chap, he was called Arius, and along with a few others, he was teaching that Jesus is just a man, only a man, not God incarnate, God in flesh. Now, Arius and his friends, they thought Jesus was special, very special, but just he wasn't actually equal to God. He was somehow less than God. Now, during the meeting, it's told that St. Nicholas became more and more agitated at this error, this heresy. And at one point, he got up and walked over to Arius. But he didn't have a present wrapped in paper with a bow on it. He actually slapped him across the face. Now, after he did that, St. Nicholas was deeply sorry. He realized he'd been out of order. As a result, he was put in prison overnight. But on the morning when he was released, he also learned that the council had rejected Arius and his false teaching, this idea that Jesus was not God. Now, no one condones St. Nicholas's behaviour that day, but actually they settled the matter in a much better way, because it was at that gathering that they formulated what is known as the Nicene Creed. It's quite a long one. We'll be saying it together after the sermon this morning. But John, who wrote our verses down in our Bibles, he really wants you and I to understand just who Jesus is as well, the importance of understanding rightly who Jesus is. So as we've been making our way through the beginning of John's gospel, we've seen that the Word, that's John's name for Jesus, the Word, is eternal. There is never a time when Jesus did not exist. And John's very clear that Jesus was with God and is God, hence the Nicene Creed. But also that Jesus made everything. He is, if you like, our uncreated creator. But then in verse 14, which you have on the service sheet, we're told that Jesus became flesh. What that means is that Jesus did not begin as a baby 2,000 years ago, but he did become one. Jesus has always existed, but at that first Christmas, he took on flesh, became a baby. That is the wonder of Christmas, the wonder of the incarnation, as we sometimes talk about it in church. Jesus, who is God, took on himself human flesh. In other words, God was now visible on earth. Which is why Christmas is not marking the birth of a great religious leader. It's celebrating the long-anticipated arrival of God himself. Picture on the screen, quite a famous one. I wonder what you see when you look at this picture. Maybe some of you will see a young woman, some of you will see an old woman. What about this one? Fairly obvious. What about now? See something slightly different. Well, when we think about Christmas, we can think about Christmas in two ways, it seems to me. On first glance, it may look as though God is nowhere. It's commercial Christmas these days. It's all about presents and holidays. But actually, John wants us to remember that it's about God now being with us. God is now here. That's the amazing news that John wants us to understand at Christmas. And what's really helpful is that John himself saw Jesus, but he's written it all down for us so that we may see it as well. Which is why there in John 1 verse 14, he can write, "We have seen his glory." It's a way of saying, look, we've seen God on display. He's been walking around amongst us. We've chatted to him. We've met him. We've seen his glory. So that raises the question for us, doesn't it? When John looked at Jesus, what did John see? Well, I've got two things to draw our attention to this morning, two things that John saw, and they give us two reasons why Jesus today is worthy of our wonder and our worship. We've been listening to Neil and Anna singing about how we should come and worship Jesus. Well, two reasons this morning. Firstly, Jesus is greater than the tabernacle and prophets. Now, to most of us, you might think, well, I don't even really know what that means. Well, we're going to look at what that means, and hopefully by doing so, we will better understand why it is actually very significant. Jesus is greater than the tabernacle and the prophets. Now, when we're not in times of restriction, we normally go and visit family at Christmas, as I'm sure many of you do as well. And when I go down to where I grew up, we go down on the A38 and we see this sign. It's always quite an exciting sign because it means I'm nearly back seeing family, as it were. By the way, if you're wondering which ocean Plymouth is Britain's ocean city of, it's not the Atlantic or the Pacific or the Indian. It's the English Channel. So there's a little bit of marketing speak going on there, but it's still a wonderful sign to see. But it's not as good as actually arriving and seeing my family. That is, of course, much better than just seeing this sign. Now, in the Old Testament, in the first half of our Bibles, God gives us signs that point to a better reality, something better yet to come. And we've got two of those signs mentioned in our verses, the tabernacle and the prophets. So we'll look at each in turn. You see that phrase there in verse 14, made his dwelling among us, translates more literally as tabernacled among us. And a tabernacle was another word for a tent. So what verse 14 is saying is, look, the word Jesus, who is God, became flesh, became human, and pitched his tent among us. Now, if you wake up tomorrow morning, look out the window, and you see a tent in your garden, then Great Aunt Mildred pops her head out, that might be a bit of a surprise. But that's nothing compared to what Jesus has done. You see, in the Old Testament, tents were really quite important, not just for camping holidays. They would be what people often lived in all the time. But more than that, God gave instructions to the people of Israel to build a particular tent for him. Now we might think, well, why does God need a tent? But this tent, which is known as the tabernacle, was significant because of what it symbolized. It symbolized God being present with his people. So rather than thinking of them just being somewhere out there that we can't see and can't quite grasp, he said, well, build a tabernacle and in some way I will be present with you in that tent. It was a sign of God being near his people. That's the tent in the middle. Then it had this sort of courtyard area outside. And that was a great encouragement to the people because they'd just come out of slavery for years and years and years in Egypt. They were wandering around in the wilderness. Was God with them or not? He said, well, here's a sign that I am with you. Now, they couldn't actually see God or get too close or go inside the tent, but they had the tabernacle with them. But they would also hear from God, usually through the prophets. And two are mentioned in our verses. John, that's John the Baptist, and then Moses there in verse 17. Now, if you remember a few weeks ago now, John the Baptist, we're told all about him. He had a very important job to do, to witness, to bear witness, to tell people that Jesus is the light of the world. So John was passing on a message from God to the people about Jesus. That's what prophets basically did. They were messengers. They would pass on to people what God had said for them to pass on to the people. And Moses, who's also mentioned here, did a similar thing in the Old Testament, particularly with the Ten Commandments. They were God's instructions of the best way to live, God rescued his people out of Egypt and then said, look, this is the best way to live as my people. And all of that was very helpful at the time, as you can imagine. But there was always some sense of distance as well between them. God wasn't actually living in the tent, in the tabernacle. God wasn't speaking directly to the people, but via a prophet. It's a bit like that sign to Plymouth. I've sort of arrived, but not really. I'm not yet talking face to face with my mum. So before Jesus came to earth, people could look at the tabernacle and they could listen to the prophets. But then John tells us something remarkable about Jesus. God has come and pitched his tent, tabernacled among us, literally living and dwelling among us. And Jesus is the Word, who doesn't just pass on messages from God. Jesus is the message. He is God. So do you see how when Jesus arrives 2,000 years ago, it's a massive change for people at the time. Because ordinary folk could not see God or hear from God directly. But in Jesus, we, they, now can. Jesus tells, explains, describes just what God is like and tells us what God says because he is God. That's John's point. So of course he's better than the tabernacle and the prophets. And in one sense, St. Nicholas was right to get so cross at what Arius was teaching because Arius was so wrong. The most wonderful and remarkable truth that Jesus is God dwelling amongst us. Jesus walked and taught. People could see him and listen to him and chat with him and sit down and have a meal with Jesus. And had we been living in Israel 2,000 years ago, well, we could have done the same. So if we want to see God, Jesus says, well, look at me. If we want to hear God speaking, Jesus says, listen to me. That's the first reason why Jesus is worthy of our wonder and worship. But there's a second one. It's that Jesus is glorious. He is full of grace and truth. Now, here's an interesting thing. Our man Moses mentioned in verse 17. There's a time recorded for us in the book of Exodus, in the Old Testament, when he asked to see God, to see God's glory. And he was told by God, of course you can't. No, he wasn't. He was told by God, you cannot see me and live. In other words, seeing God comes with a health warning. It was a dangerous thing to do, just like looking directly at the sun is bad for our eyes. Looking upon God directly is a dangerous thing to do. And that's fundamentally because God is pure, God is holy. We'd be okay if we were pure and holy, but we're not. None of us are, and nor was Moses. So in the end, what happens is God does appear in front of Moses, but he hides Moses in a rock so Moses can't really see, because to do so would be too dangerous. But what John is saying in verse 18 is that he's seen God. In verse 14, he's seen God's glory. So how can that be? Well, the answer is verse 17. You see, if Jesus came only with the law, that's God's instructions, God's law, God's commandments, which we all fail to keep, which we ignore at times, then it would be a dangerous thing for us to see God. Like Moses, we'd be better off hiding in a rock. But in verse 17, we're told grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. It's there in verse 14 as well, just so we don't miss it. Jesus is full of grace and truth. Now, grace is that wonderful word which means undeserved kindness. Essentially, it's the difference between a gift and a wage. 2 days ago, if you were given a present, then having unwrapped it, you were asked to then pay for it. It wouldn't be a present. You don't earn a gift. If you did, it wouldn't be a gift. Jesus is full of grace, undeserved kindness, grace and truth, we're told. That's not so much that Jesus didn't lie, although that is true. Jesus always spoke the truth, even when it was uncomfortable to hear it. But true here, I think, is in the sense of trustworthy. That is, he's true to his word. He's consistent to his character. He always acts as you would expect him to ask. There's no two-faced attitude to Jesus. No duplicity, no surprise because he's acting out of character. He's always true. If you've ever broken a spoke or buckled a wheel on your bike, if you take it to the mechanic at the bike shop, he will fix it by putting it on a truing machine. He's not testing to see if the wheel is telling lies or not. He's seeing if it spins true, if it runs straight, stays its course, doesn't wobble. Well, that's what John is reminding us about Jesus here. He is full of grace and truth. And those like John who saw Jesus, saw him, who he really was. They saw Jesus and said, well, there is grace and truth personified in Jesus' care for the weary, his compassion towards the hurting, his comfort to the fearful, in his healing of the broken and love towards the outcast, always full of grace and truth. That's why Jesus is so beautiful to read about and see. But we don't only see this grace and truth dwelling amongst us, but in Jesus dying for us. See, Jesus didn't come to earth to just lie in a manger or to live a life of grace and truth. Not just those things. He did those things. But it was also to be lifted up on a Roman cross in your place and mine. Verse 17 reminds us, if Jesus came only with the law, well, we should be hiding, because the law could never save us. But Jesus came with grace to give us what we don't deserve, to give us what we cannot earn, to save and not condemn. And this wonderful gift, this blessing, is pictured for us in verse 18 in a little way, to bring us to the Father's side as well. Picture of relationship, perfect relationship. So Jesus did not come to only tell us where we've gone wrong. It's a mistake to think that. He came to put everything right. A free gift to all who will receive it. The promise of restored relationship with God the Father for all who want it. And the point of verse 16 is that Jesus has enough grace for everyone who needs it. He gives from the fullness of his grace. It's the idea of grace upon grace upon grace. Abundant grace that never runs out. Before the swimming pool shut again just the other week, I'd go quite often and I would end up drinking a lot of the swimming pool. I won't tell you how I know that, but you can probably work it out for yourself. But when I go back the next day, I don't worry that the pool might be empty because I know there's more than enough water for me to swim in and swallow. Or if you've been to the beach, you get home and you look at the car and it's full of sand, which is a little bit irritating, isn't it, at times? But you don't worry that the beach now has no sand in it. You know, there's more than enough sand, even if some comes in off feet into one's car. John's point here is that when we come to Jesus, say, Jesus, I know I don't deserve this, but will you give it to me? He doesn't check his pockets to see if he's got enough grace. He's full of grace and truth, abundant grace, overflowing grace, grace upon grace upon grace. So whenever we come to Jesus, we need never worry that the grace he offers has run dry or run out. Because as John reminds us, the Word became flesh. Salvation became flesh. Grace became flesh. And his name is Jesus.